almost a year ago, it's kind of hard to believe, it was almost a year ago, just as all the coronavirus stuff was beginning to take shape in the news. But it was all in China. It felt very distant. And very soon it wasn't distant. But it was about this time, a year ago, my family and I took a vacation to Florida. We went to Disney World, and it was great. It was funny. Florida was experiencing historically high temperatures for February. It was in the 90s, I think, almost every day. And you know, it was very cold here. There was snow and ice and slush. I remember we drove down. It was like 20 hours. We drove down. We got in the van here in my driveway in White House. It was cold and dark and snowy, but we didn't care. It was almost like the more wintry it was here, the better, because we knew the contrast was going to be that much more striking as we went down south, and it was. As we went down south, it was like with every passing hour, it got a little warmer. By lunch, it was in the 50s, wherever we were, Tennessee maybe. As we kept driving and driving, forgetting how long Georgia is. It doesn't seem that big on a map, but it's gigantic, as is Florida. I remember hitting the Florida border and saying, kids, I know you just saw Welcome to Florida, but we still got a long way to go till Orlando. So don't think that we're almost there, okay? And they were okay. Because part of it was the journey was exciting because it was getting warmer with every passing hour. And even when we hit the Florida border, we knew we had a ways to go, but it was sunny, there were palm trees, and it was February. We just thought, this is really nice weather for February. It was a long drive. We ended up staying the night. I think it was that first day, I think we stayed the night in somewhere in southern Georgia. And we drove the last 6 hours or so the next day. So it was a lot of driving. The kids were in the car. They had stuff to do. But you know, kids and adults alike, they get antsy in the car. And yet, people were so courteous with each other, so patient, so forbearing. That's one of the things we always talk about when we start a family road trip is the principle of forbearance. Forbearance is when we just simply let things go that irritate us. It's an important trait to have on a long car trip. It was great. And we had a wonderful week in Florida, enjoying the weather, enjoying fun stuff. And you know what was funny is even though the trip back was really exactly the same, just in reverse, everybody's attitudes, including my own, were not nearly as charitable. With every passing hour, it was getting colder. And instead of driving on this road trip with the prospect of Disney World, hugging Mickey Mouse, riding the teacups, it was, ooh, we got to start school again tomorrow. We got to start work again tomorrow. With every passing mile, we're heading closer to getting back to reality. And nerves were frayed. I remember stopping, I don't know, Tennessee, Kentucky, that first night we stopped in a hotel. We had Chick-fil-A, and normally when we're all eating Chick-fil-A, everyone's in a pretty good mood because it can't be that bad when you're having Chick-fil-A. And everyone was tense. We were tense. And things like people chewing loudly seemed particularly irritating. Or, you know, someone's not passing this to me quickly enough. It just seemed that much more irritating. And it was just interesting how much different, even though the trip distance was the same to the mile as it was a week before, how different our attitudes were. And the thing was not the highway, because the highway was the same. Wasn't the length of the trip. We hit traffic on the way down. We hit traffic on the way back. We had pretty decent weather on the way down. We had pretty decent weather on the way back. But what made all the difference was where we were going, right? Our motivation, our mindset on that trip, going down versus coming back, was totally different. And it made all the difference in terms of how we handled that trip, how we handled the challenges, the unexpected things, the difficulties, the irritations. It made all the difference. Today we're going to look at Psalm 26. If you'd like to turn there. What we're going to see in this psalm is a mindset on godliness. A mind that is set on a life to be lived in pursuit of godliness. We're going to talk about what exactly even that means. But like our trip to and from Florida, our mindset made all the difference in terms of not the actual events of that trip, but how we handled them. Like that trip, our mindset in this life, what we focus on, what we're locked onto, where our gaze is, will make all the difference when it comes to whether we live lives in growing godliness or not. David helps us to understand this as we look at Psalm 26, and as is typical, I want to encourage us to look at this in a few different layers. One is to look at this from David's perspective. King David wrote this. And he didn't write it disingenuously. He wrote it with, first of all, himself in mind, and also wrote it as a psalm that the people of Israel could sing. This psalm, as we're going to see, is kind of a self-admonition, a self-exhortation to live in godliness. One other important layer, the crucial layer, though, is to understand this in light of Christ and his saving work, what he's accomplished on our behalf. That even as David in this psalm commits to wanting to live a godly life, that we understand that David could only ever do this very imperfectly, and Christ is the one who ultimately fulfilled the inclinations, the desires, and the purpose of this psalm. But then the final layer that we need to read this in is that of ourselves, understanding that David wrote this about himself as a foreshadowing of Christ. Christ was the ultimate and complete and literal fulfillment of the words of this psalm. But because of our union with Christ, we can claim this psalm as our own. And what we're going to see as we read Psalm 26 is this: that we're called to live in wholehearted pursuit of godliness, which also happens to be the path to true joy. Let me read Psalm 26. It says this of David: "Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity, and I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. Prove me, O Lord, and try me. Test my heart and my mind, for your steadfast love is before my eyes, and I walk in your faithfulness. I do not sit with men of falsehood, nor do I consort with hypocrites. I hate the assembly of evildoers, and I will not sit with the wicked. I wash my hands in innocence and go around your altar, O Lord, proclaiming thanksgiving aloud and telling all your wondrous deeds. O Lord, I love the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells. Do not sweep my soul away with sinners, nor my life with bloodthirsty men, in whose hands are evil devices and whose right hands are full of bribes. But as for me, I shall walk in my integrity. Redeem me and be gracious to me. My foot stands on level ground. In the great assembly, I will bless the Lord. Like David, we're called to live in wholehearted pursuit of godliness, which is the path to true joy. And in this psalm, what I think we see are three main themes woven throughout this psalm that help us to understand why we should, one, why we should seek after godliness, and also what exactly that is. And I hope that as we look at this psalm together, it's going to help us understand what exactly a life of godliness looks like, and to help us better understand how we, as those who are united with Christ, can and should pursue it. So first, godliness involves trusting that seeking God and seeking His standards is best, that that's best for us. Verse 1 starts with an interesting prayer. We've seen David begin many psalms instantly in the beginning of verse 1 with some kind of plea. Help me, O God. Save me, O God. Rescue me. And what's interesting is the word that he uses here is vindicate. Vindicate me, O Lord. That is to say, show that I was right. Show everybody around me that I made the right choice. What's that choice? What is it exactly that he wants to be vindicated about? He says, vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity, and I've trusted in the Lord without wavering. David's plea is for God to look on him differently because he sought after godliness. That word translated integrity there. I tend to shy away from the use of the word literally because it's often misused, particularly when pastors are explaining the translation of Greek or Hebrew. But I would argue that the more literal translation of this word is wholeheartedness, which better aligns with the second line when he says, I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. He says, God, I have trusted you. I have lived in such a way as to show that what you want and what you demand is best. Therefore, I pray that you would display through how you work in my situation that I would be shown to have made the right choice. Because as David says, I have walked in my integrity. That is to say, I've walked in wholehearted pursuit of you. To put it another way, I've trusted in the Lord without wavering. What David's getting at here is his self-admonition, his pleading to the Lord in prayer by affirming the fact that he has understood that seeking after the Lord singularly, not seeking after God as one of many things that can deliver him or help him, but to seek after him wholeheartedly, to seek after him without wavering, that is to say, without kind of veering this way and then coming back when that thing lets him down. But this is David affirming that God is worth trusting, not as one desirable thing among many, one helpful thing among many, but as the ultimate and only one worth ultimately putting our faith in. In verse 2, he says, prove me, O Lord, try me, test my heart and my mind. That's a bold prayer. To say, God, examine me and see that I have sought after you wholeheartedly. This can come across as arrogant. When I read this at first glance, this can sound very self-confident. God, I am wholeheartedly committed to you. Examine me and see. And yet what this is David pleading with God to evaluate him. Evaluate me, God. Test me and try me, because I want to live according to what you want. We'll see in a moment that this is done according to God's power, and David recognizes this distinctly in verse 3, but we'll get back to that in a moment. David continues this line of thinking. This line of thinking of God is ultimately the only one worth pursuing wholeheartedly. By, in verses 4 and 5, thinking about those who don't. I don't sit with men of falsehood. I don't consort with hypocrites. That is to say, the ungodly are those who are focused on how they appear toward other people. People who are defined by deception and by hypocrisy are those who care nothing for integrity, nothing for the idea of their inner life matching up with their external life, but people who are primarily concerned with how they appear toward other people. Talks about the evildoers, the wicked. That is to say, people who say, I don't care what God's standard is. I just don't care. I'm going to simply do whatever it is that I want. He says, I don't sit with them. I don't consort with them. I hate their assembly. I will not sit with them. David wants to be different. David doesn't want to straddle the fence of influential yet sinful people in this life, and yet understanding and recognizing that God's standards are best. He says, God, I want to pursue you wholeheartedly. I know that their end is death and condemnation. And understand that to walk in godliness means understanding that what they're doing is futile. It's only adding to their condemnation. That I can't say I want to pursue godliness and also be kind of okay with running with this crowd, kind of dabbling in what they do. But that what you expect is wholehearted pursuit of you and your standards of godliness. And I understand that this is ultimately what's best for me. I don't straddle the fence because I know what you want is best. In verse 6, I wash my hands in innocence and go around your altar, Lord. Rather than hanging out with the ungodly, adopting the ways, the principles of the world, David said he wants to be near God's altar. Instead of sitting with the wicked, I want to be near your altar. It's a metaphor. A metaphor for David saying, I want to position myself and order my life in such a way as to set me up for godliness. I really want this. I really want to be godly. I really want to walk in a way that's pleasing to you. I don't want to adopt the ways and the practices of the world. David begins by acknowledging before the Lord that he has generally practiced wholehearted pursuit of godliness because he knows that it's best. Even though he's facing a difficult situation, he knows it's best. David would have been more mindful than anyone else of his own flaws and shortcomings and stains on his record of seeking after godliness. And yet, as we're going to see, he rested on God's grace and mercy, even in making this claim. We also understand that this kind of statement was something that Jesus fulfilled perfectly, exhaustively. As the one who could say, look at my heart and mind, you will find nothing wrong at all. And as those who are united with Christ, we ought to do the same. We see an implicit call to godliness here, a wholehearted kind of godliness, with a clear implication that it's simply the best way to go. To actively seek godliness is to reject the world's ways of doing things and to make decisions that reflect God's worth, God's authority. Christ is, as I said, the ultimate example of this, but we're united with him. So it only makes sense that we would want to seek this kind of life as well. Do we understand that this kind of life, a life in which we're seeking after godliness and seeking to root out the sinful influences in our life, that that's ultimately best for us? That's ultimately what's good. We don't do it out of a sense of guilt or obligation, but because we know it's best. Do our decisions reflect the conviction that godliness is best? It's easy for me to nod my head in affirmation of even my own words right now on Sunday morning sitting in church. But does my daily life reflect this? Do the decisions that I make with my time, particularly my discretionary time, reflect this? Do the way that I interact with people, my relationships, do they reflect this? Do things like the way I spend my money, the way I conduct myself on social media, do these decisions reflect the conviction that godliness is best? That I want to seek after a life that's wholeheartedly committed to the Lord? Godliness involves trusting that seeking God and his standards are truly best. Secondly, what we see here is that godliness is motivated by God's love and empowered by his grace. It's simultaneously motivated by his love and empowered by his grace. In verse 3, David says something that's pretty theologically rich. He says, "For your steadfast love is before my eyes, and I walk in your faithfulness." That is, David begins the psalm by saying, "Vindicate me, O Lord. Put on full display the fact that my wholehearted pursuit of you was the best thing for me to do." And then in verse 3, he quickly acknowledges, "The only way I could do this is because of your love, because I see your steadfast love before me." He's motivated primarily by God's goodness. That phrase, steadfast love, I've said this before, is a translation of a single word in Hebrew, one of the most theologically significant words in the Bible, and the word that, as far as I know, is the most frequent, the word most frequently used to describe God's character, chesed, translated steadfast love. Not just love, but a love that endures, a love that is faithful, despite the waverings of God's people. David sees this, and when he meditates on God's steadfast love, it stirs his affections for God. He says, "I can walk in wholehearted pursuit of godliness because your steadfast love is before me, because I think about, I look at, I gaze on your steadfast love. But also, I walk in your faithfulness, not in my faithfulness, in your faithfulness." David's not boasting in this psalm about what a great godly person he is. Because in places like the second part of verse 3, he readily acknowledges that his pursuit of godliness is empowered by God's faithfulness. God has promised to enable his people by his grace to to live a life that's pleasing to him. So David says, I walk in godliness, one, because I see your steadfast love. I'm focused on it. And I know it's your faithful grace that's supplying what I need to do it. In verse 7, after the phrase in verse 6, when he says, I wash my hands in innocence, I go around your altar. In verse 7, he says, proclaiming thanksgiving aloud and telling all your wondrous deeds. David's life of godliness, pictured in verse 6, it has big implications in verse 7. If we understand verse 6 to be kind of a metaphor, it's not really that David just spent all of his life hanging around the physical altar at the temple or at the tabernacle. It was a metaphorical picture of how David wanted to orient his life. Rather than sitting with the wicked, I want to sit by your altar. But it has implications. The two big implications I see here are our attitude and the outward result of that attitude. Proclaiming thanksgiving aloud and telling all your wondrous deeds. That is to say, David's life of godliness led him to gratitude, thankfulness, a thankfulness that he couldn't keep to himself, but involved proclaiming and telling. David understood that to live a life of godliness was a life that was motivated by God's love, was fueled by his grace, and led to an attitude of thankfulness and a desire to tell other people about him. In verse 11, he says, but as for me, I shall walk in my integrity. Redeem me and be gracious to me. So we see here, once again, David making an affirmation. I'm going to walk in my integrity, and yet it's simultaneously coupled with a plea. God, I'm going to walk in my integrity, but I can only do this if you redeem me and you're gracious to me. God has answered that prayer for redemption in Christ. We don't have to wonder how or when or if God will redeem us from our sin. He's already done that. And through Christ, he gives us grace. That is to say, empowerment that we can't muster ourselves. We don't deserve it, but it's simply a manifestation of God's steadfast love for us. We can commit to a life of godliness, simultaneously understanding it's only because of our union with Christ and his saving work and God's empowerment that we can do it. In Matthew 11, 25 to 30, Jesus says this, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and understanding and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for such was your gracious will. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Jesus' encouragement is this. You can seek after self-righteousness all the day long, like the so-called wise and lofty of this world, and just be frustrated. But he says, Father, thank you so much that you've demonstrated your mercy by instead giving these things to little children. That is to say, us. Those of us who are conscious of our weakness and our frailty and our shortcomings. He says, look, do you want to live a life of godliness? Then you come to me. I'll give you what you need. And it's not heavy, it's not a heavy burden. Don't come to me and expect just another weight, just another layer of guilt, another layer of doubt and shame. But the yoke I give is actually a yoke that makes your life lighter. An empowering yoke. A freeing burden. We can grow in godliness. We can only grow in godliness when we approach things like spiritual disciplines, things like prayer and Bible reading, fellowship like this, understanding that knowing God is a privilege, and the ability to do these things, the ability to walk in godliness only comes from His empowering grace, simultaneously being encouraged by the fact that He does provide the grace to do it. We're not left to ourselves. But it's also best pursued with God's character, His worth, His faithfulness, His love as our focus. Rather than looking down and trying to walk forward and continue to be engaged in what we're pursuing, we look forward to the horizon. We gaze up at God's character, His love and His mercy. Because godliness is ultimately motivated by God's love and empowered by His grace. Thirdly, finally, godliness is grounded in a desire to be in God's presence. David longs to be in God's presence with God's people. And he understands that those who reject him will be condemned. And for David, he understood clearly that his ultimate reward was to be in God's presence, and that to be banished away from God's glorious presence forever was the ultimate punishment. In verse 8, he says, "O Lord, I love the habitation of your house and the place where your glory dwells." David here, we can see plainly, his pursuit of godliness is not motivated by guilt. It's not motivated by fear. It's not motivated by duty or obligation. He knows that God's presence is the best place to be. He knows that this is just where I want to be. In verses 9 and 10, he says, "Do not sweep my soul away with sinners, nor my life with bloodthirsty men, in whose hands are evil devices, and whose hands are full of bribes." He understands that the worst part of rejecting God in this life is that they will suffer God's judgment. They will not only never get to experience the true and lasting joy that comes from dwelling in God's presence, but they will suffer active punishment. And so he says, in the midst of this intertwining of self-admonition to say, I'm going to walk in godliness, I do walk in godliness, intertwined with prayer, God, by your grace, I can do this. Your love is before my eyes. Be gracious to me. Even as he reminds himself of the ultimate end of those who don't walk in godliness, then in verse 12 he can say, "My foot stands on level ground. In the great assembly, I will bless the Lord." David can walk in assurance. Even in the midst of all the crazy things that happened to him in his life, he could face a difficult situation, a scary situation, with assurance, with determination. Only because of his identity as one of God's people. One of the people who will, he knew, spend eternity rejoicing in God's presence because of the sheer satisfaction of God's presence. That he would be celebrating forever with his brothers and sisters, God's redeemed people, God's goodness in his presence. And that motivated him to live a godly life now, to fight his sin, to seek after godliness, to cultivate a love of the things that are pleasing to the Lord, and to reject those things that are displeasing to him. In 2 Timothy 4:8, Paul says, "Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing." That's a fascinating way to characterize Christian people, isn't it? Who will be awarded the crown of life? Those who, when Jesus comes, they say, "Oh man, I've been waiting for this. I can't wait to see Christ." Because the Christian life is ultimately a life of affections. A life that has been transformed by Christ so as to say, "I hate this trash that the world offers me. And without Christ, I'm just messing around in the garbage pile." And Christ offers me something totally and radically different. Ultimately, the joy and eternal satisfaction that comes from him himself. When our heart is divided, when our love toward God is cold, we should pray that God would give us a discontentedness to settle for the things of the world, and that he would stir our desire to know and to love him. It is perfectly valid for us to say, "God, I understand that my desire to know and to seek after you is just not what it should be. Stir my affections, Father. Stir my heart, that I would become simultaneously more discontented with the things of this world and more wholeheartedly focused on knowing you and your steadfast love. That we would eagerly await being in his presence." It's important for me to emphasize, like David readily recognizes in this psalm, that this is not something we do of our own strength. The last thing I would ever want to do is preach a sermon that makes anybody leave here thinking despairing thoughts. To leave here thinking, "Wow, I've really blown it, and all I can do is blow it." But that we would leave here understanding, one, that godliness is best. We seek after godly living. We seek after a life that fights sin actively while also actively cultivating our love for the Lord, because it's best. We do it with a readily acknowledging that it's motivated by God's love, not fear. Cultivating godly practices in our lives based on just fear of God's wrath or something will be short-lived at best. But like David, a life that's motivated by God's steadfast love and understanding we're empowered by his power, and knowing that its end is not just discipline for discipline's sake, but knowing that the ultimate end, the ultimate goal of the godly life is knowing that we are cultivating the affections that will be ultimately fulfilled in heaven in Christ's presence. Let's pray.